This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Pod Staff. With me today, I have two guests. One, we're going to call a co-host for today, my girlfriend, Allie. And then we have Caitlin Wilkinson. So Caitlin is the Director of Behavioral Health for Ellis County, Texas. So Caitlin, without further ado, I'll let you tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I got my master's in 2019. And I have spent the entirety of my social work career working with people with severe mental illness until 2 years ago when I took on this role with the county. And now I'm doing a lot more macro level social work or even meso level social work and a lot less direct care.
So, yeah. Because you used to do like all social work, right?
Yep.
Okay.
I did. I was a field-based case manager at MHMR in Tarrant County for 10 years. Well, I worked there for 10 years. I was a field-based case manager there for a couple years. Then I moved into a training position teaching other case managers how to do that. And before that, I worked at the Center for Healthcare Services in Bexar County. And that was kind of where I got my start in social work, was in San Antonio and doing case management.
What is MHMR?
My Health, My Resources.
Okay.
It formerly stood for something else, but all of the MHMRs around the state have kind of rebranded to be a little bit more inclusive language. So My Health, My Resources, meaning, you know, come in and we will get you connected wherever. Even if this isn't the right spot, we will get you connected to the right level of care.
Is that even classified as like micro, or is that the micro, macro, just therapy?
That's definitely micro level work because it's very direct care. And so when you're, you know, sitting with somebody doing their full biopsychosocial assessment, their treatment plan, you're doing weekly sessions with them, that's absolutely on that micro level. Which honestly, it is my jam. I love that.
Yeah.
To a point, and then I'm like, I'm ready for a break. I'm ready to go back into like a leadership training, whatever kind of role.
Yeah.
That sounds very similar to my story because I started as a case manager and then ended up being a supervisor. But my demographic was 18 to 21 year olds.
Oh, so you were doing the transition age.
Yes.
Stuff.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, it was really hard. It took a toll on me for sure.
They're technically adults, but their brains don't work like adults.
Not at all. No. What did you work with all ages?
I didn't. I work only with adults. I have zero experience working with youth and adolescents, which is a detriment. And actually why I was so interested in Veronica when I did hire her is that she has worked only with youth and adolescents. And so it's nice to have that balance there of my brain works only in the adult space.
Yeah.
And her brain works only in the adolescent space. And so it's a nice mix.
And y'all at the county level do all of it, right? All ages?
We do. We don't do much direct care. The only direct care that I do is with the Veterans Treatment Court. So I do the treatment coordination for our veterans in Veterans Treatment Court. So if they need substance use treatment or mental health treatment, if it's, you know, therapy for PTSD, I'll try to get them connected with the modality that's the most appropriate for them. And I do a lot of direct care with them, which I absolutely love. I honestly, the veterans I work with are probably my favorite people, but I do not do any other direct care. Otherwise, it's talking to families about what their family member or loved one needs.
So are you doing direct care to veterans because that's your passion or because that's also part of the job?
It's also part of the job, but also I love it. So I have always had a strong interest in the criminal justice system, especially where it comes from, like the social work part of it. Because we do know that you know, the criminal justice system is the, you know, largest treatment facility for people with severe mental illness and substance use disorders. And so when I started this job, it was at the same time as my colleague Brent. And he started a week before me, and I started, actually tomorrow is 2 years since I started. And we kind of decided, we built that program together. It was a grant, and they said, here, you know, make this grant, Brent. And he was like, cool. And he put together all of the policies and procedures. He's like, I don't know anything about the behavioral health stuff. You know, can you help? And so we've kind of put that together as a unit, where he really runs the whole thing, and I just give my clinical opinion on things. But it was initially like the first part of the job that I was assigned. And then I absolutely fell in love with it. The first group of veterans we brought in, I was like, yes, this is where I'm
going. So that was written in his plan, right? That mm-hmm. we were going to give back to veterans, mm-hmm. and we're going to make it part of the county's mm-hmm. job to do that. And that's where yep. you're kind of heading that up now.
Yep. Okay. He was hired specifically to run the Veterans Treatment Court.
Okay.
And so that's his focus. He's you know, done a lot more outreach mm-hmm. now, but that was the original purpose, and it's grown substantially since then.
Yeah, and going back to the criminal stuff, I mean, that's one of the things that she, like we'll be sitting around, and you know, I just want to watch maybe a nice feel good movie.
And you're breaking it down.
I'm like, I want to watch true crime.
Yeah, you walk into the room, and it's like murdered family in kitchen, suspect on the loose. And I'm like, man,
absolutely. Yeah. I just made my husband watch the Jodie Hildebrand documentary last night.
Oh, I haven't gotten into that one yet.
Yeah, it's interesting and very sad.
Yeah, she's very crazy. But our stories are very similar. Like, yeah. I'm into, you know, true crime, criminal justice. I've always loved that aspect. Yeah. Of my job in social work, which I dealt primarily with domestic violence more so than anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was always going to bat for them, and you know, going hard, always in court. But
especially like having to testify. That's very intimidating.
Yeah, it is, and especially for them, like they're victims advocates. You know, they weren't always doing their job, so a lot of times that's where I would step in and just kind of like push them, because I'm sure that you know sometimes they'll get a restraining order or protection mm-hmm. order, and then they won't show up to court, or they'll drop it and get back. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just pushing them, and you know, you really got to be a one-man show sometimes.
Yeah.
But I loved it. Yeah.
When it sounds to me like social work is one of those where it's like, it's never a 9-to-5. Like,
no,
you're available.
Absolutely not.
24/7 pretty much.
Yeah. No matter how many times I try to set boundaries on my work hours, I can't do it.
It never works.
It doesn't, which is okay, right? There's some flexibility in that, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm taking calls late at night, or there's an emergency and I'm helping and it's late, I'm able to kind of come in a little bit later in the day the next day, or later that week. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take today off because I've already worked 60 hours and it's mm-hmm. Wednesday. So
we're gonna
take it easy on Friday.
Yeah. Or you can, you know, take an afternoon off to do a podcast.
Or you can take
podcast. Exactly. I do miss that, the flexibility. Yeah. But then I think back and I'm like, well, I didn't really stop working for 5 years. So even on vacation, you know, I would have people still like they still need you. So
yeah. Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough finding that work-life balance.
Yeah.
And the toll that it takes on you mentally too.
It does, but when you're passionate about it, right? Like mm-hmm. that part just kind of happens. You can't really help it. And no, like I said, no matter how many times I really do try, I'm like, I'm not going to work late tonight. I'm not going to work late tonight. I'm not going to work late tonight. And then there's a crisis and somebody needs help getting access to resources, or they need, you know, a bed at a psychiatric hospital or something like that. Then I'm like, all right, let me get on the phone and I'll start calling, you know, the people that I work with that can help with bed placements and things like that. And it ends up being, you know, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night that I'm finally like, okay, mm-hmm. we're good. We're done.
Yeah.
That was a long night, but we're good. And this person is safe and they're healthy and, you know, they're alive. So.
And I remember whenever we were scheduling our intro call for this, you had one of those crises come up firsthand. So what was that again?
So a lot of a few of the police departments will reach out and ask for help. So if there's somebody that is in a crisis and they need help with placement or things like that, or they're not really sure if it would meet the criteria for what's called an APOW, or an apprehension by a peace officer without a warrant, which is that emergency detention to a psychiatric facility, they'll call in and consult and say, you know, is this something that you think is appropriate, or you know, we're not really sure what's the most appropriate location to take them. We don't know if a psychiatric facility is appropriate, or we need to go to an emergency department mm-hmm. first, or mm-hmm. And so usually that's what it is if it comes up in the middle of the day. Sometimes it's that there's a situation in our jail and If there is an employee that's in crisis, sometimes I will go help with the employee, things like that.
Oh, so okay. It's a jail employee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or not even just the jail employees. I mean, it's other people around the county. You know, they have, mental health needs as well, or their family members do. And so a lot of people have come and asked for help getting their family member connected. Mm-hmm. Especially in the early days of me starting this job. That was the majority of what I did, was talk to people. They were like, hey, I have a family member that has this need, or a family friend has this need, and I don't know where to start, or I don't know what words to say. I don't know how to communicate what we need. And so I got to spend a lot of time with different people around the county, kind of helping them figure out how to navigate that.
Is that based mostly, like, I guess, what's the most common reason for them reaching out? Is it substance issues? Because I know you mentioned in our call before, you know, the detox centers and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And how a lot of times, like, you know, someone could be in jail or in a setting like yeah. that, and they were on the drug or the substance whenever yeah. they came in, and then they're still there, but now they're having withdrawals or something like that. Is that kind of where you evaluate the ER versus psych unit?
Before, yes, a little mm-hmm. bit. We actually, just in the last year, put into place a couple of different treatment providers. So we now have our local behavioral health authority doing the jail psychiatric care. And then our medical provider there does the detox. So we're able to detox people now safely in the jail, which is so nice that we're not having to go off-site. Because if we were having to send people to the emergency department, you know, an officer has to stay with them 24 yeah. hours. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard on the officers. It's hard on scheduling. It's for the jail leadership. So now we're able to do that here on site and not have to worry about that. If they do need a higher level of care that we can't meet in the jail, they will take them to the emergency department. But now they have like a protocol within the jail between psychiatric provider and medical provider where they talk it through, and I don't have to participate in that anymore.
But you put that together though, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. you've orchestrated this whole thing in the county jails. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so our last provider, they did a great job, but it was taking a while for people to see a psychiatric provider, you know, a couple of weeks. And the reality is that there's not enough time for that. Sometimes it's emergent. Mm-hmm. And they did a great job, but they ended up deciding not to move forward with the contract. And so the renewal of the contract, so we were like, hey, we have an opportunity to kind of change what we're doing and save the county a lot of money in the process. And so we brought in another medical provider that was comfortable working with a third party mental health provider. We brought in the local behavioral health authority.
Wow.
A lot of it for the continuity of care. So a lot of the people in there are already receiving services out in the community from our behavioral health authority. And so to have them in there, they can pull the records, they can see what medications they were on, they can really continue that care in the jail, and then when they leave, they can just go right back to what they were doing. There's not a big transition.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That was my first big win in this position was getting that approved through the commissioner's court. They were so wow. supportive of it, getting those contracts put together. And when we rolled that out December 16th of last year, it has been a game changer. I get calls from defense attorneys all the time saying, my clients are actually getting psychiatric care in the jail. Yeah,
wow.
That's the point. That's the idea.
That's incredible.
I was going to ask too, like the pushback that you might get, because I know a lot of people, like I think now our world is going towards, or at least in the U.S., we're kind of paying more attention to mental health mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I just kind of wondered, is there any, there's still a bunch of people out there that yeah. are like, you know, just suck it up and don't do the drug or don't commit the yeah. act or don't do this or that.
Yeah.
And they just talk about it so broadly and so simple. Have you experienced a lot of pushback when trying to get these policies passed?
Yes and no. So the elected officials that work in Ellis County, so the commissioners, the judges, I think they all really get it. They mm-hmm. see it. Their constituents are the ones that are calling and saying, hey, I don't have access to this. So they're actually the ones that recognize the need in the community to start the department to begin with, mm-hmm. Which was really nice. And having grown up in Ellis County, I did not anticipate that. So I was pleasantly surprised with how well received this all was.
Yeah.
But I think that came on the back of some people that have been working in the county for decades, really advocating for people to understand the need of behavioral health care. And so I can't take credit to say like, oh, you know, they receive it really well. That came after a lot of really hard work and advocacy from people in the juvenile justice department, in probation, in the court system. So our justice system recognizes the need, and they were a big push for this. There are some people, not I would say that work here, it's been so well received by people within the county, but there are some people in our community that have that mentality mm-hmm. of, well, you chose to do the job. You chose to do, you know, you picked up that drug in the first place, and it's always really interesting to explain that.
Yeah, just kind of like lack of empathy.
Yeah.
It's like you don't really have to fully understand, but at least understand that you don't understand.
Yes. Yeah, well, and to recognize it for what it is, and usually it's something along the lines of, no one woke up and said, I want to be addicted to meth.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
That's not something that someone woke up and said, I think that would be a good idea today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that always kind of, you see the light switched on, and you're like, yeah, I guess that's true. I'm like, You know, they don't want this. They also don't want this. They yeah. want something different for mm-hmm. their lives. If their brain worked differently, then I wouldn't have a job, which would be phenomenal. But it's not that easy. It's not as easy as putting it down. And it's not yeah. the moral injury that people think that it is. And that has been a little bit difficult across the community. But that's anywhere. Anywhere.
I think there's a lot of factors that go into it as well, like how they were raised, which is especially what I dealt with yes. in independent living, right? So that was just their norm. Like yeah. they grew up watching that.
Yes.
Some of the foster homes aren't great either. So. Right. You know, yeah. it's there are so many factors that go into it that people just don't even want to think about.
They don't. And there's this whole field of study, right? And I know you're probably familiar with this, but the adverse childhood experiences study.
Yeah.
We can quantify and very easily predict who is going to struggle
Absolutely.
With addiction, who is going to struggle with mental illness, who's going to struggle with physical health, early deterioration. Because of what they've experienced, because of their childhood and how they grew up, seeing people using drugs, seeing, you know, severe mental illness go untreated, mm-hmm. you know, experiencing abuse, either, you know, being the victim of it or, you know, witnessing it, we can very readily predict who's going to struggle. And so I think it's interesting to try to get that to translate to,
yeah.
you know, if we did some prevention work over here, we might right. see less of this.
I feel like there's two sides to it because I feel like you hear a lot about, like, the kid who grew up around an alcoholic father, mother, whatever, and they grow up and they're an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Then there's their sibling, maybe a twin.
Teetotal, nothing.
Nothing. They don't yeah. ever pick it up. They're so scared of it. And I yeah. feel like that's I don't necessarily think I've heard much about anything in between.
Yeah.
You know? And I think partly, too, like the addiction side of it is... kind of what came to mind is really it's like your mind working against your soul because yes. you can have a really good soul and like you said your mm-hmm. soul does not want to be addicted to meth. Like your soul didn't wake up and say, hey,
yeah.
Meth is on the docket today for the first time ever.
But I think I'm gonna try this today. Yeah,
yeah, but your mind did or yeah. maybe your mind had a weak moment and now your mind is constantly tricked yep. into thinking that this is what I should be doing, but your soul yeah. still knows it's not right.
It does. And, you know, I could nerd out on this all day because, you know,
Please
you start
do.
Talking you start talking about neuropathways, and that's what addiction is, right? Where we try something and it creates new neuropathways, and your brain is trying to keep up with those new neuropathways that, you know, you're trying to get dopamine and you're dopamine seeking, right? But the more you use it, the more your brain needs it because mm-hmm. it continues to create these new pathways. And it's so interesting when you start talking to people that have never really considered that to see the wheel, and you can see it. You can see the wheels turning of trying to understand it, which I absolutely love mm-hmm. because it's like, okay, we have another ally. We now right. have somebody who understands this on a, you know, on a cerebral level of it's not, you know, you're a bad person, you're a terrible right. human being. Mm-hmm. It's your brain is forcing you to do something that you don't want to do. And there is that cognitive dissonance there where it's like, I know that I shouldn't be doing this, but I have to. Mm-hmm. My brain is seeking it out. Yeah. It's no different than having a sugar addiction or caffeine. Yeah. If you get a headache by 10 o'clock because you haven't had your coffee, that's addiction.
Exactly.
You know, so.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times, like in a recovery setting, I want your thoughts on this because in a lot of recovery settings, it could be substance, it could be mm-hmm. pornography, it could be, you know, just a number of things.
Yeah.
But though the groups in those settings will tell you, especially whenever you're new or whatever, to not trust anything your mind tells you.
Oh.
And wow. I've seen that happen, and then I've heard of it kind of the other way where it's like, no, let's do a more holistic approach. But I think there's some programs that are so rigid to where it's like, yeah, some people, maybe you should not trust what your brain says because you've been doing heroin or meth for 30 years. Like, that might be a case where you probably should listen to others only. but there's also the confidence piece where it's like, if you're trying to get someone back on their feet and help them out, it, to me, that seems like a way to have almost zero confidence in yourself. And that's kind of like that lack of self-worth a lot of times is what drives people to pick up the drug or drink in the beginning.
Yep. And that is an interesting point. And treatment providers all are so very different, right? And so it depends on, you know, why they started, what substances they treat, who they treat, right? And so it is, there can be programs that are incredibly damaging. On the whole, I think people who get into the treatment business do it because they want to help. Mm-hmm. And they think that they have a way that can help. And there are some people that absolutely need that, that need to be told, for right now, let's not trust our brain. Mm-hmm. For right now, we know that we're going to be having triggers. We're going to be having cravings. And those cravings are so convincing, right? They are so convincing. I think about that with, like, chocolate. I don't always have a sweet tooth, but when I do,
it's unstoppable.
It's unstoppable. Nerds clusters are my kryptonite, and like, I can't have just a couple, right?
It's
and
like so, cheat days.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly. You can't just have a couple. Yeah, like, you have to go all the way,
and you justify it, right? I'm like, well, I was pretty good this week,
or it's too far gone at that point. Like, maybe you started your morning off with some of those, and you're like, well, today I'll
screw
just,
it. It's already done.
I mean, it's, what am I going to do? Take it out of my body? I might as well put
today's out. Like, we'll start again tomorrow. But that's absolutely a mentality that people struggle with any kind of addiction, with food, with, you know, alcohol, drugs, like you said, porn, anything like that. It's like, well, I've already done it.
Yeah.
I've already damaged it today. Today's out. So might as well, we'll start again tomorrow. And that's a really dangerous perspective to have too.
Yeah, and it's like, that's just the justification that you were talking about earlier. It's like your brain, literally your pathway tricking you and convincing you, like, because let's just say you pick up a beer and you know you've been sober for a while and you know you shouldn't, but you picked up one.
Just gonna test
so,
it.
Yeah. So then you're like, well, I already had one. I might as well get hammered today.
Yep.
And then start. It's like, who told us that it had to be in increments of days?
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I don't understand that.
Well, you know, in 12-step programs, particularly like AA or NA, they really do talk about it one day at a time. Don't beat yourself up over today, right? It's just today. Mm-hmm. It's okay. And I think that that's really important, but that's also a peer-run program. It's people who have been in it, and it is, you know, people who have gone through exactly the same thing. And so they do, I think a lot of it is take it one day at a time, and you think, okay, well, my day is already done.
Yes.
I might as well be done. And then that turns into 2 days, and that turns into 3 days. And then we all of a sudden have a bender. And,
but it's then like a good thing
that can stop.
Yeah.
They can just stop, right? They just put it down and never touch it again. And it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I had a guest last night, we did a podcast, and he was someone who struggled with addiction heavily for years, like decades. And we were just kind of talking about, like, he didn't do any 12-step program. He had something really bad happen. A number of bad things happened, but he finally had something that was so bad that he was like, yeah, I can't. This is done. And then he just stopped.
That's crazy.
And I think that, like, really, you don't... And we're talking, like, hard drugs and alcohol and everything. And it's like, you hear that, and then you hear someone who maybe... Hey, I think it's just levels of conscience. Like, like, some people have a really high pain tolerance to where it's like, they can maybe wreck a car, and they're like, well, you know, that was bad, but I think I'm going to keep going. And then there's people who are like, man, I said something mean to my wife. I got to be done. So I think it's just weird to see the different tolerance for that.
Yeah.
You know, there's you're kind of touching on a concept of like trauma-informed care and trauma-informed services, because that's exactly the same for trauma. It's that way for depression and anxiety and addiction, where everybody's brain operates a little bit differently, right? So to the car wreck example, someone can completely smash their car, total it, and move on. They're like, all right, and they drive tomorrow. That's me. I'm like a terrible driver in my 20s. Awful.
Oh, me too.
But still like ready
still
to
in
rock,
your 20s.
Right? And you know what?
Still,
still ready to rock, right?
But then, still going, though.
I have a friend who got in a fender bender, and it was intense, but not, you know, life-altering, and couldn't drive for years.
Oh,
just
yeah.
felt so
yeah.
scared to drive, especially on the highway. And you're like, that's so interesting, because we grew up together. So I know a lot about your experiences, but the way that their brain, yeah. you know, processes yeah. that. And it's the same with addiction. It's the same with mental illness. Some people respond so well to medications. You put them on an SSRI or, you know, a tricyclic antidepressant or whatever, and they do great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, this is, you know, snapped out of it. Then there's the people that have treatment-resistant depression or anxiety or things like that. Those are the people that tend to be in our behavioral health authorities receiving mm-hmm. services there, because it's so intense that they then can't work anymore, and
yeah.
their families
mm-hmm.
get tired, and so they lose all their support. And,
yeah.
you know, and it snowballs, where it started with the same kind of concept, right? Like, I had something really bad happen to me. I experienced some trauma from it, but the treatment didn't work, and here we go down this rabbit hole.
Yeah.
What do you think about SSRIs or antidepressants in general? Because
love them.
I definitely think that they are helpful, but mm-hmm. I think, like, I have someone in my family right now that has been on all of them throughout their life,
mm-hmm.
and they keep saying, like, "Oh, this one doesn't work. This one doesn't work." And it, to me, it's like, after 20, 30 years of trying them all, maybe you should add something else in there too.
Yeah.
Maybe you should add some exercise.
Yeah.
Maybe you should add some support
yes.
groups. Because I think people think it's a one size fits all,
yeah.
like, where it's...
And you want to.
Yeah, you want
you
to.
Want
I mean, that
to,
would be wonderful. That mm-hmm. would be awesome. But from personal experience, you know, I thought that they were pretty good, but I feel like they had to be coupled with everything
yeah.
else as well.
Yeah.
Holistic
yeah.
point of view.
Same.
But they're hard to get off of.
Yeah.
They are. The side effects of detoxing from an antidepressant can be really intense.
Mm-hmm.
I have been on Wellbutrin for years. I also have a therapist that I see that every once in a while, she's like, when's the last time you've gone for a run? Because you're not in the same space that you were before, and that's what works really well for you.
Yeah.
So it's great to take the edge off, and that's how I've always kind of explained it to people is, you know, medications can take the edge off so you can get in and do the work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not gonna fix everything for you. Antipsychotics for people with psychotic disorders, absolutely. But then you do have to pair it with treatment. You know, it's not just medication. You can't throw a pill at things
yeah.
and hope they go away. It's the same thing for cholesterol or diabetes or whatever,
yeah.
right? We can treat it with medication all day long, but if you still eat poorly, you're still gonna have high cholesterol.
Exactly.
You're still
right.
gonna be at
yeah.
risk of a heart attack, no matter how many, you know, cholesterol meds you take.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that's a very important distinction to make, is it doesn't fix it. It doesn't just, you can't swallow a pill and your life is better. That would be phenomenal. I would be out of a job,
yeah.
and I don't know what I would do with my life,
yeah.
but it would be really convenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just, that's not the reality. It'll
yeah.
take the edge off of whatever it is. It'll take the edge off the anxiety or the psychosis or the depression and allow you to get into the work.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've talked a little bit about your social work experience, but tell me what you, like, what that looked like for you. When did you start? How did you get into it?
So my story is actually really weird. I graduated college with health science, and then I thought I wanted to be a speech therapist, so I went
nice.
To grad school at Marshall University in West Virginia.
Okay.
So I got into that, and this was during COVID, and so I was like, well, I might as well use my degree and get a job while I'm in, you know, grad school.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a posting for a case manager position with independent living, and I was like, okay, let me interview with this. So I got the job, loved it so
yeah.
much that I was like, I could not see myself doing anything other than this.
That's cool.
And
that's
so,
how they draw us in.
Yeah, I made the decision to say screw it. I went with case management. I worked with 18. At the time, it was actually, this is why our stories are actually super similar, because it was also a pilot program,
mm-hmm.
but just for the state of West Virginia. So we started up that territory with independent living. And at that time, we had a license for 17-year-olds to 26. So we were just getting
okay.
flooded with referrals
yeah.
from, you know, the state, and putting these kids in apartments. They would get money from the state. We would put them in apartments, you know, kind of teach them basic life skills. And I was pretty much their lifeline, like their parent, you
yeah.
know. Because you think about these kids are coming from, a lot of times, from juvenile detention centers even.
So that was my next question, is were these kids that had aged out of the foster care system
mm-hmm.
or they were just released from from the juvenile detention facilities, things like that?
Yeah, so most of the time it was foster care, but a lot of times it wasn't. Like, I think my first client, she had come from detention center. She was in there from 8th grade to 18. She didn't even know that you had to swallow pills. She was chewing pills. Like, she had no idea. She was never taught anything. She, you know, didn't really talk. And I mean, it was depressing. Because, of course, I come into this field, like, bright-eyed and, like, ready to make an impact. But, you know, she was my first client, and I was humbled really quick.
Yeah.
So, you know, that really changed my mindset and my life, honestly. And then working with the resources in West Virginia, there are none. And that's a state where they kind of want to keep you in that cycle. Like, it's impossible for them to get ahead because there are no resources. There are really no people that want to help. And even, like, their case managers with the state, I was luckily with a private agency, but the case managers, you know, that they had many of were not helpful. They were mean to them. That's something that always blew my mind. And my time as a supervisor, you know, I always told my case managers, be nice to them. These aren't felons. These aren't people that did anything wrong.
Even if they were, it's a human being.
Be a human. Like,
this is a person.
And that's something where I know a lot of people that I've, you know, met in the field, we've always disagreed because, you know, they want to come at them like, you need to do this and that and, you know, kind of boss them around. Why? Like, show them some compassion. You might be the only person that's done that in their life. And a lot of times, that is the case.
What was the hardest part? Because that's a really tough age, right? Like, that transition age is really difficult because there's really not a lot of resources available. Once you hit 17, you've kind of aged out of juvenile care.
Right.
But you can't get adult care until you're 18. And so you've got this weird space, but you're not really an adult when you turn 18.
Oh, no way. Yeah.
So what was the hardest part about that work for you?
There were so many. I went into it when I was 22. So you think, you know, some of our clients were 17 to, I don't think we had anyone over 22, but we were like the same age. So it was kind of like the blind leading the blind, like, for a little bit, you know.
We're going to figure it out together.
Yeah. And I think just like the ups and downs that they would have was a lot for me to get used to because they would have stints where they would be doing so good. And I felt like so proud of the work that I was doing. But then it just in the same, like, the lows were so low, the highs were so high, and just kind of navigating that because there weren't a lot of wins. So like celebrating those small wins that they would get, that was always something that I loved to do and something super important to me. And back to what you were saying about, you know, not really having a work-life balance, that my first 2 years, I didn't at all. You know, it was all day, all night. I was
sleep and breathe it.
Yeah. And I think that not everyone is like that. It's how passionate you are. You do allow it to consume your life. So I didn't have a life. My life was making sure that they were okay, especially in West Virginia, because I dealt with so much domestic violence and, you know, they were with partners who were horrible and just making sure that they were alive, really.
That's awful.
Yeah.
And that does, and that's burnout city too, right?
Like,
you're so passionate and you do this work and you're like, I'm gonna give it my all. But then you burn out and it's hard to come back from that burnout. It's really hard to come back from that burnout.
Yes.
So is that something you experienced in that role?
Absolutely. I faced that within, I think, right after my second year. I was like, I don't know how much longer I can do this. And then I moved to Lexington, Kentucky, worked the same position, then moved to supervisor. So once I, you know, because at one point my caseload was 22 young adults and we have to see them once a week, you know, and I was so involved in it that, you know, I was seeing them more than once a week. Imagine 22 clients, like, trying to, that's like having 22 kids.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. So
especially high need, like high risk, high need, a lot of high risk.
And then having to do paperwork when you come home, like, I was never off. It was horrible. I know.
It's the worst. And
did you have to, like, log every conversation that you had and stuff like that?
Every visit. Yes.
Yeah.
Every time I saw them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then being in a supervisor role was really nice because, you know, I didn't really have a caseload, but then it was the largest office within our company. So I kind of still had to put out the fires of everyone else's caseload, but
so you get a little bit of that direct care just enough to keep you passionate, but then you get to kind of step out of it.
Yeah. But I think that experience was really good for me because I, you know, I got to see who I was as a leader and, you know, I really learned a lot from that. But then we had some corporate changes, like leadership changes at the corporate level, and I just was, a lot of stuff just didn't morally align with what I wanted to do, so then I got into sales. But I still talk to my clients that I had, like, we text all the time, and, you know.
Yeah, they'll call her with, like she has this one girl that she'll call her out of the blue and just tell her something awesome that happened.
Oh, that's so
just
because
she wants her to know.
Because there was somebody who cared.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of the times, you know, you are the only one that cares.
Yes.
And it's really sad. And that's why I always told, you know, my case managers, like, you don't know, like, you, be the only nice person in their life.
Yeah.
Why would you not?
Especially with people that age, they've clearly been let down by the people around them. And you kind of touched a little bit on, like, the systemic oppression of people that are, you know, coming from, you know, disadvantaged backgrounds, right?
But,
you know, it's not a system built to help people thrive.
No, it's
not. It's a system built to keep people where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really unfortunate, because it is, like, you have people that really want to do something, but then you're beat down from it. The system is not set up for success. Every one of us are set up for failure.
Absolutely.
And it's something you kind of recognize going into it as you've done it for years, but, you know, that's tough, because especially in rural areas, there's nothing.
Yeah.
There's often nothing. You've got to drive hours just to get to a doctor sometimes.
Yeah. And even just getting into college, like, I know that it's a common thing that people think, like, you get free college if you're in the foster care system, and you do. You've just got to jump through every hoop imaginable.
You've got to, you know, apply, you've got to write the, you know, essays, you've got to know where you want to go, what you want to study. I mean, it's...
From the outside looking in on this, it seems like there's all these things in place on paper that make it seem like this is, you know, we're helping people and we're doing this stuff. And that's probably why people get into it, because they're like, wow, I can work with this. And then you get into it, and that's just crazy that, like, you said, the system works against itself. Like, that's
absolutely.
I can't imagine having a job where, like, every day you're fighting, you're trying to do something good, but you're fighting against the people who are trying to allow you to do something good.
Right.
Yeah.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah. It really is. And it can be maddening. And there's kind of a, like, if you can stay in social work for 5 years, you're going to stay in it. But there's, like, this 5-year burnout, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that if you don't make it to that 5 years, this isn't for you.
Yeah.
Because that is so common. And especially when you're working with, like, some more of the marginalized populations. So people that have experienced domestic violence, you know, youth in foster care system, people who don't have income or insurance or things like that. That's the system that's built to keep people there.
Absolutely.
And what did you call that?
Indigent care.
Okay.
Yep. And so that's where my heart is. That is my absolute passion. I really tried to get into private practice. I did. And I just could not leave, you know, that population, the indigent population, because someone's got to stick around, right? Like, and the people that work in this part of the field all feel the same way. Like, someone's got to care. Someone's got to fight the fight.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming you can make more money long term in private practice, right?
So absolutely.
That's basically, like, even if you didn't do it, or maybe you tried to do it and then you went back, like, that's a big sacrifice long term.
It is. It is. And, you know, some of the positions that I had considered and positions that I had been offered paid quite well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when I would turn them down, my husband was like, huh, okay. Okay. I'm like, I know, but...
He's like, I could have gotten a real Rolex.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry, babe. I told her about the Folex.
But all right. She has a 48.
We're cutting that out.
Yeah, he made a joke. He was like, I could be a stay-at-home dad with that. I'm like, you could be a stay-at-home dad. Please, for the love of God, don't. But yes, you could.
That's another thing, too, is you are often not paid enough.
Yeah, it's an underpaid field.
This episode is sponsored by Dive Fit. Dive Fit is a faith-based clothing brand rooted in Christ and built on consistency, structure, and personal growth. Dive Fit's mission is to help people show up stronger in their faith, their health, and their daily lives. Check out their collection today at die-fit.printify.me.
So I do want to hear, and I'm sure Caitlin does too, about some of the stories that you've experienced in social work.
Where do I even begin?
With the horror stories. You know we're all here for it.
I was going into these clients' apartments by myself. We had one client, the first time I walked into his apartment, he was just, his vibe was very eerie. Mm,
I know that. I know that feeling. Well, and your spidey senses are telling you something
wrong. And it wasn't that sly, because he had like three life-size dolls of Michael Myers, like all these posters of serial killers. He wanted to be in the army, like loved guns. So I was like, okay.
It's distressing.
Yeah. And that's another reason why I left, is because I felt like I didn't have a lot of support. Yeah. Like, you know, I would tell my leadership, like, I don't feel safe going into this apartment by myself. And they're like, well, absolutely, we can't kick him out for being creepy. And I was like, I understand, but
can I get some backup when I go?
Yeah. And like, why is there not a risk assessment? Like, this guy's clearly screaming like I'm going to do something bad.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, he just wants to scare you. Yeah. And one day it's not going to be enough.
And yeah, he did.
Yeah, and he sure did.
That's problematic.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many things that I never, luckily, I had never had to see before. And it really opens your eyes to the fact that, you know, these people have been through so much. And the things that they've been through within the foster care system, a lot of their trauma comes from the foster care system.
Yes.
And even people like youth service workers, males that are trying to hit on 17-year-old clients, like that's something I dealt with a lot too. And
gross.
There's not a lot that gets done. I don't know how it is in Texas, but in West Virginia and Kentucky, there was like nothing that would get done.
That's incredibly disheartening.
Yeah.
Because if you report somebody and nothing happens, you're like, well, what's the point anymore? And
yeah.
And then you know you can't see it anymore and sleep at night knowing that it's happening and there's nothing you can do to help.
Right. Yeah.
That would be incredibly disheartening.
Yeah. There's just not a lot. Not a lot of resources. They don't get heard. They don't get taken seriously either, especially with that label of, you know, a young adult or child in the system. Like, they don't get taken seriously. They're almost, like, looked down upon for that.
Yeah.
And that's something
kind of
that's
forgotten by society.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was always the one that, I know that school counselors, they hated to see me coming because, you know, if there was a disservice,
that's
I was
how you
there.
Know you're doing your job well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I was. People are nervous when they see you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've always made sure that they were taken care of because there are so many injustices that they face that they don't think anybody is going to care about. So.
And they're right.
Yeah, exactly.
They're right. They are absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
People don't care.
And they take advantage of it.
It's so uncomfortable to see it. And there's this culture of toxic positivity, right? And that drives me nuts, especially in like the behavioral health space. That drives me absolutely bonkers. That it's like, oh, everything's fine. No, it's not. It can
it's
be okay
not.
And suck at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, they're not competing. They can be happening at the
it's
same
like
time.
It's like recognize that we're trying to do something good.
Sure.
But it's not good yet.
It's not good.
Recognize that we have a system in place that's meant to help people, but it's not working quite well yet.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
exactly.
You can recognize that it's there and also recognize that it's not doing its job. That
two
it's,
things
that
can
it's
be true at once.
Absolutely.
She always says that, yeah.
Yes.
It actually is that's a, two things can be true at once. Like, that is a very simple quote, but it's really helped me because sometimes I'm a very all or nothing type guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not so much black and white, but pretty much like all or nothing.
Yeah. You're either in or you're not.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's kind of, you know, reminded me from time to time, like, you can be one way and feel another way.
Absolutely.
There's two things that are true at the same time, and that's okay.
They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Right.
They can happen together. I experienced that so much when I was pregnant because I hated every second of being pregnant.
Oh.
I hated it. It took so long to get pregnant. We had to do, you know, medications and, you know, IUI and years of not being able to get pregnant and things like that. And then when I finally got pregnant, I was like, yes, okay, this is what we asked for. This sucks so bad.
Yeah.
I am so uncomfortable. I hate being pregnant. I'm tired. I don't feel good. This is not fun for me.
Yeah.
I'm not enjoying this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was a lot of that toxic positivity that was like, but at least you have.
Exactly.
You should be grateful. I'm like, yeah, I can be grateful and feel like shit at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
It can happen.
Exactly.
Simultaneously, you
and
know.
And that's real. Like, that's just real life.
It is. And that's so funny that you say that so much to him because I say it often to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that he heard me say mutually exclusive and was like, oh God, here we go again. Because that's, you know, you do. It's like these things can happen at the same time. You can be grateful for something and also resentful of it as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, that's not competing.
She also has told me a saying. It's just, yeah, I'll worry about that later. And
that's tomorrow's problem.
Especially, like, and that's just like another simple thing that really helps me because I'm someone, like, if I'm starting something or I'm thinking about doing something, I'm like locked in. I want to get it done. I want to do it. And she's, and it ends up a lot of times, like, I produce good work from that mentality.
Yeah.
But it stresses me the hell out. And sometimes she's just like, why don't you just worry about that later? Just tell yourself you're just going to worry about it later.
Especially like intrusive thoughts, you know, I always say, let's think about that later.
Yeah.
Just because it distracts you enough to get your mind off of it. And then you, with us, we end up just finding something else to think about.
Yeah.
It's that Hakuna Matata mentality where you're like, you know what? For right now, I can't.
Yeah.
And that is important to be able to shut that off. And it can be really difficult to shut that off too, where it's like, I can't, because if I shut it off right now, I'll never come back to it.
Yeah.
So it's like that toeing the line between that and then like being present in the moment. Because like saying I'll worry about it later can really lead to you being present in the moment, but then you might not get to it later. You know, there's a rabbit hole you could go down on that, but I think it's just different for everyone.
Yeah. And honestly, there's this like inability for people to pay attention long-term for things. And that plays a part in that. Cause I feel you on that, where it's like, if I don't get it done now, I'm never going to do it.
Yeah.
There are so many emails sitting in my draft that, you know, if you're waiting on email, I'm sorry, it's going to get sent. But there's so many emails sitting in my draft because I'm like, okay, this happened, I can worry about this later, and then I never come back to it. Mm-hmm. So there is a level of anxiety that can come with that too. And it's very interesting how there can be these two very different personalities, right? Where you're like, we'll worry about that tomorrow. That's tomorrow's problem.
Yeah.
We're not going to worry about that today. And it's like, I have to worry about it now because I need to get it done.
You just have to decide what's more important.
Yep.
Like you your peace or like, can you have just a little less peace and get by and then get that peace back?
Yeah.
Or is it just going to be too far gone for the day?
Yeah.
Like we talked about earlier.
Is this going to bring me peace? If I finish this, do I get peace later today or not?
And it goes back to the topic. We've talked about it on multiple episodes where, you know, you think that when you reach this goal, you're going to, all the stress is just going to drop.
Oh.
Like I remember my mom, she moved to South Carolina, moved to the beach. And I think, you know, throughout that journey, she vocally kind of was like, yeah, I think that, you know, once I get there, man, how could I ever have stress at the beach?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, it follows you. Like, it doesn't have to be like overwhelming, but it still follows you. It's just, you're never going to get to that point that it's like, oh, everything is all good now.
No. Well, and you're also talking about patterns too, because it's not just, I'm going to leave my problems here, right? I think people do think that they can outrun it. And that's where you get addiction. That's where you get anxiety and depression and things like that. Because when I do move on and it follows me, what is happening? And some of it's recognizing those patterns that you're actually bringing this on. That's not always a bad thing.
Yeah.
But maybe it's that I'm not, you know, putting myself in the right frame of mind to process this differently, or, you know, not, you know, I haven't actually resolved this. Mm-hmm. I've just moved on and hoped that environmental changes will make it go away.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you just said what I was going to bring up, hope. Because I feel like that is the root of a lot of it. It's like, if I'm working towards a goal and I believe that that goal is going to, once I accomplish that I'm going to be free of that stress, then it's almost, it's kind of weird because it's almost like you feel better while you have the hope.
Yes.
Yeah.
And whenever you get the actual item or the status or whatever that you were going for, that hope goes away and now we have to find another hope. So it's like that hope pattern that I think is us trying to do well for ourselves. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it doesn't fill the void in us.
Yeah.
And, you know, but we talk about stress too. And as you're talking about that, you're talking about like achieving a goal and then it doesn't relieve stress. And some stress is good and healthy and motivating. Mm-hmm. And there's a level of like anxiety that's normal and appropriate and life-saving, right? Like anxiety is our body's way of saying something's not right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something's not right here. And so people want it to completely go away. I want no stress. Well, that's not realistic.
Right.
You know, if you are hungry, there's going to be a little bit of stress where your body's saying, feed me.
Right. Yeah.
I'm hungry now. And so you've got to figure out something to eat. And there's still stress in that, right? So, you know, and not, I mean, that's kind of a flippant example, but, you know, people really think that stress and anxiety are these really evil, vile feelings to have, but honestly they're healthy and life-saving and life-giving.
Yeah.
Because then you're like, okay, I've accomplished this. What next?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because who just wants to coast? Well, a lot of people, actually, that's not.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Plenty of people just like to coast.
That's what I struggle with, too, is like once I do achieve a goal, it's like, okay, on to the next thing.
What's
like,
next?
There are things that, like, if you told me that I was doing now in high school, I would be like, oh my gosh, how could you ever be sad? But now I've achieved them.
Look at your life, yeah.
Yeah, I've achieved them, and I'm like, oh, should be here. Like, it's always like, I can never live in the present. That's something I'm trying to get better at, is just enjoying what I have right now instead of thinking, like, okay, what next? How can I be better?
Yeah. Well, it's like content versus complacent almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for women especially, there is this societal pressure that is put on us. And so if you are content, if you are sitting still, you're lazy. You're not moving forward. You're not doing enough. If you're not moving upward and onward, that's problematic. But don't do it too much,
because
that's too masculine.
Yeah.
And we don't like that. And you're making, you know, people uncomfortable. And don't be too bossy, because that's bossy. It's not good leadership. And there's this like societal pressure that gets put on us that if you're too ambitious, you're a gold digger.
Yeah.
And you're like, whose gold am I digging?
Yeah.
I'm trying to dig for my own. Like, I want my own gold. I'm not trying to dig for gold.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that that's very real, especially for women, that we don't actually get to be content.
Yeah.
There's always something, and we're kind of put in this space where we're expected to be martyrs too. You have to give of yourself and give up a lot to be considered a good woman.
Right.
And you're like, well, I can be a good woman and do all that. I work full time and I have a child and I think I'm a decent mom and I think I'm an okay wife. I'm sure my husband would be like, yeah, okay. You know, like just okay. But I'm just kidding. I talk about him, but he's actually very, very, very sweet and very kind.
He's going to watch this and be like, seriously? Dang.
He's going to be like, for God's sake. He's probably one of the greatest people I have ever known in my life. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't marry him. But, you know, all joking aside, we do have that.
Yeah.
Do what?
You don't hear that often where someone says that kind of compliment about their spouse.
He's pretty awesome. Very nice. He's all right. We'll keep him around. My mom jokes. She's like, I guess you can keep him around for a while. He's a pretty cool guy. But there is. There's pressure. And those things, though, also kind of end up leading people to drinking.
Yeah.
Substance abuse in stay-at-home moms is unbelievably
common.
Yeah.
And I think you probably may have experienced that some in your last job of seeing kids who were the product of that, right?
Absolutely.
And that leads to, you know, other generations having struggling with addiction, but then also there's abuse that comes with that, or neglect that comes with that. And it's never, I think a lot of times it's not meant to be harmful, but it does happen. And so I'm curious how many of the kids that you worked with kind of experienced that, where their moms were the ones actually struggling with addiction.
Honestly, more than not.
Yeah.
I would say about 75%, but the substance abuse rate with my clients was nearly 100.
Yeah.
Probably like 95. They all had some kind of substance abuse issue.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's interesting, because I think when most people think about addiction, they think about men. They think about men struggling with addiction, because that is where we see a lot more of the like violent stuff. And so you think of this violent person, but what you don't think about is how readily available alcohol is.
Right.
And so it's socially acceptable to drink a bottle of wine. That's wild. I would be on the floor. Unless it's good wine. But like, you know, it's, you think about how easy it is. I can joke about that and it's not inappropriate to be like, I love a good bottle of wine. But if I were to be like, I sure do love a good hit of crack, that's wild.
Yeah. That's where we draw
the
judge.
Line. Yeah.
Right. Then we're judged, but it's so readily available. And so I think it's so underreported for women. You know, statistically, you know, men have higher rates of addiction. But I think that it's socially acceptable for a lot of the addictions that women experience. And it's encouraged. It's readily available. Like it's there. If you can drink a dude under the table, that is awesome, right? Like that's not normal.
Yeah.
Right.
To celebrate, but that is something that gets celebrated. Is women's, especially like binging misuse of alcohol.
Yeah, and I think addiction in men and women, it looks a lot differently. Like you said, like the men are more stereotyped as like a violent drunk, but women, you know. I've met some female alcoholics that you would never know that they were drinking, right? So it just looks different a lot of the times.
Yeah.
And you even see some women. I have seen a lot of women that, you like, if you are around them when they're drinking and you see this turn, and you're like, this is not.
Yes.
We've reached a point, but it's, you know, it's alcohol, so it's socially acceptable.
Exactly.
And you know, for women, it's a little bit more acceptable to have substance use disorders.
Right.
It's a lot less stigmatized mm-hmm. than men, I think.
That's interesting.
Unless you're a single mom, and then it's stigmatized.
Because, right.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Wow. So I want to move on to the topic of faith. Mm-hmm. So we had talked a little bit about your faith journey, and it's I would describe it as unconventional. But I also thought it was very inspiring. So if you just want to walk us kind of through that journey, maybe growing up till right now.
So for the early part of my life, grew up in the Midwest in Champaign, Illinois, and my mom was very involved in our church. I grew up and was baptized Presbyterian, and so we were very heavily involved in that until we moved to Texas. And we did some churches here and there, but couldn't really find one that felt like home. So for the most part, as a kid, we didn't do a lot of stuff in our church. When I got out of college, I got a lot more involved in the Presbyterian church. And there's a pastor that I absolutely love, Betsy Lockhart. I always felt like she was speaking directly to something that was going on in my life mm-hmm. in the moment. She would have this sermon, and I was like, how did she know?
Yeah.
Every Sunday, it was, how did she know? Mm-hmm. She's a wizard. And so she was just somebody that we felt comfortable with. And so when she would move to different churches, we kind of would go try that church out and see if we liked it. And we just really liked her leadership. And so when I got into my early 30s, my husband and I joined the church that she was ministering. And we got really involved. The Presbyterian church is an aging population. And so we were kind of the unicorns, is what she would call us, mm-hmm. because we were younger people coming into the church.
Right.
And she'd asked me to join as an elder. And so we did a group vote, and I was elected to become an elder. But during the training for it, the people that I was in, you know, these classes with in my church were very clear that they didn't think that I belonged in that role. Mm. And this was while I was in grad school and while I was, you know, working full-time in MHMR. And it just kind of felt too much to fight. Like, I didn't have any fight in me for that.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm not going to fight with you guys if y'all don't want me here. And they never did anything overt.
Yeah.
But they made it very clear that it was, you know, you're too young and you don't belong here, or, you know, you haven't been with the church long enough. And it was just,
that's so sad.
That's
very sad. And I feel like that's one of those stories where it's like, I think a lot of listeners would say that they've had a negative experience mm-hmm. in some way with a church or two or three. And that's just another example. Yeah. And it sucks because it sucks because what it's supposed to be, and what I've experienced growing up, is churches, people who are, you know, struggling, wanting to, you know, work towards a common goal, or mm-hmm. you know, have God interject in their life and help them. And I've always had a positive experience, but I hear, you know, I've had a lot of guests on here that have told me about how they still have faith in God, but they don't have any faith in the church.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I kind of feel. You know, the church, the walls of the church are great. I think that, you know, if that's where you get, you know, your passion, and that's where you kind of feel filled up, that's great. Mm-hmm. That was the last time I went to church mm-hmm. consistently. And I was, you know, maybe 30, 31, and I'm 40 now. And so that was 10 years ago. I've gone on holidays, right? Like, you go for the candlelit service for Christmas Eve and stuff. But even that I haven't done in a couple of years. My son hasn't been baptized, which kind of breaks my heart, because I do want him baptized, and we talk about God a lot. But I do not feel filled up in a church. I feel like I get that fulfillment of my faith doing my work. And I feel like it's important to, and I think I told you this in our call before, but like, I walk my faith. I don't have to talk about it. And I don't talk about it very often. Mm-hmm. Most people probably assume I'm an atheist because I just don't talk about faith. But it's there, and it's deep, and it's very intense. But it's something that I feel like I can show it. I don't have to talk about it. It's something
yeah,
like I think I can act out.
Yeah. That sparks conversations, too, because I think a lot of people, before building trust with people, they want to tell them about faith or what to do.
This is how it's supposed to look.
Right. And while it, you know, maybe they're onto something here and there, that doesn't resonate with people. And I feel like my mom's a good example of this. She's not someone who talks about faith a ton with a bunch of different mm-hmm. people. But she is asked more than anyone that I've met about, like, hey, how are you, you know, so positive? How are you? It's because she walks it for the most part. And people are curious on, you know, how someone shows up like that every day and keeps that positivity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, anyways, what I was going to say is I saw Jelly Roll on a podcast the other day.
Yeah.
And he's had like a pretty open faith journey. And he was talking about how, like, he still curses. He's like, I'm an open Christian, I'm an open book, but I curse a lot. And he was like, if it comes to the point where God wants me to stop, then he will put that on my heart to stop. It's not like you have to rid yourself of everything to begin to have faith in God or go to church or do whatever your faith journey looks like. Like, that's what the faith journey is for. It's not wipe everything out to start.
Well, and it's not, you don't have to be perfect. And I think that's something that people forget is I have to present myself as perfect.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If I call myself a Christian, I have to show that I'm, you know, that's literally not the point.
No.
And how relatable is someone like Jelly Roll where he's, you know, he makes very motivational songs. He makes songs about faith, but he curses a lot and he's real. Like, I think that that's, unfortunately, you know, maybe this is an unpopular opinion, but I think that's pretty attractive. Like, that says to me, you're one of us.
Yeah.
And you also walk with God.
Yeah. You're not going to judge me when I fall. You're not going to judge me if I make a mistake. You're always going to be there. Yeah. I mean, I think that really does speak to that. And, you know, I know we were talking before this, but, you know, there's the research that shows that people that say the F word a lot are perceived as more trustworthy. I'm like,
it's probably,
you can trust me with your life.
And it's more genuine. Like,
it is.
A lot of Christians, especially growing up, you know, they weren't genuine. Like, when they would look at you and talk to you about God, it didn't feel genuine at all. It just felt like something that they felt like they needed to do to make themselves feel like a better Christian. But Christians aren't supposed to judge. Like, God is the judge. Like, that is the number one thing that, you know, is talked about in the Bible. It's like, God is the judge, not us.
Yeah.
So the amount of judgment that is passed down from Christians is just, it blows my mind.
Well, I think all religions, too. I don't even want to just put Christians in a box.
Like, yeah, that's
I think
true.
That's just what we've experienced because we went to Christian churches. But, yeah, I definitely think that it's just... It's, I think I put it on here somewhere about relationship over religion. Like, that's what you had mentioned on our intro call is, like, it's about having a relationship with God or Jesus Christ or, you know, whoever you believe in. It's not so much about attendance at church. You know, I think for me and for us, that helps. Like, it really helps my week because we found a good church that we like. And we love it.
Yep.
But that's not for everyone, and you can still walk with Jesus or walk with God without having a very good church attendance policy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my mom was part of this church that they kind of considered themselves the church for misfits. Mm-hmm. And I love that because it was people that felt like they didn't belong in a regular church. And we would meet outside on the front lawn.
Oh, I love
and
that.
Like, we spent like a month learning about Islam. And that was so fascinating because I was like, oh, I didn't realize that they pray to the literal same God as us. They just have different guiding principles and different doctrines. And it was really interesting to learn how accepting we're actually supposed to be.
Yeah.
And that has stuck with me over the years that, you know, we're all the faith that we have, the religion that we believe in, We have that because we feel like that's where our soul is being called. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I think people do mean well.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, you hear some of the, like, very vicious things that get said in the name of Christianity. And you're like, but that's not... We're supposed to be loving and accepting and...
Well, that's not Jesus.
It's like, not.
Jesus didn't design it to be that way.
No.
He didn't preach it to be that way. And I think a lot of people... judge the church or God by the people in this world, when in reality,
yes,
if we should be judging it by what was Jesus's teaching.
Yes.
Like what's
yeah.
in the Bible that he was preaching. He was preaching about
peace. Who did he
peace.
Spend his time with?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It wasn't the rich people.
Yep.
It wasn't
yeah.
the high status people.
Right.
It was the misfits, like you just mentioned.
Yes. And, you know, that I know we've talked a little bit about, like, me feeling like I'm called to work with, you know, the indigent or unfunded populations. But it's that principle of, like, there are people that are shunned by society.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't in good conscience be somebody who shuns people like
exactly.
society is.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said this a couple times, and it's just so important that a lot of times we are the only person that shows kindness, compassion, and love to somebody.
Yeah.
Especially people that have been struggling for years. You know, people look down on somebody who struggles, and it's wild. And that I really think is where my calling is. It's like, I'm meant to be working with people who have been forgotten. I was just talking about this earlier today about people who are kind of the forgotten of society. And those are the people that I absolutely love the most. Mm-hmm. That is where I want to work. That's who I want to work with. If it's somebody that's, you know, a little bit more difficult, I'm like, absolutely, that's the person. That's
yeah.
who we serve, right? Like, this is what we're here for, is for the difficult person, the person that's hard to work with.
Yeah.
That's the point. That's why we exist. Let's keep doing that. And it's exactly like you said, of like, what was Jesus actually doing?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think I get where my faith gets filled up and kind of where my cup gets filled up is
right.
I know I'm doing work that's undesirable. I know I'm doing work that is sometimes dangerous, because field-based case management was my jam, and holy cow, that's dangerous.
Yeah.
But when you come at it with love and compassion, I think that speaks for itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I haven't gotten burned out, is because I know that that's where I'm meant to be. I know that that's my calling. I know that I'm meant to help people who are the forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so while I do get burned out, you know, I try to find a way to come back to it, because
yeah,
it is
kind of rejuvenate yourself and,
yeah.
and remind yourself
yeah.
why you started it in the first
yep.
place. And I think that leads well into, you know, what I wanted to ask to close. You know, that person who feels like, you know, a misfit, or someone who's too far gone, or, you know, maybe they don't have advocates. Like, what would yeah. you say to that person if they're listening?
They're not alone. There's somebody who will walk alongside you. And I talk about this very often in my job, but you don't have to be alone. The family doesn't have to go through this alone. The person doesn't have to go through this alone. There are people who truly care, without judgment, without hate, without, you know, the stigma, who really want to help. And sometimes you have to go through a lot of really crappy people to find mm-hmm. the person that actually does care, that actually does want to pour into you. But it is there, and don't give up.
Yeah.
And frankly, if you can't find them, call me, because I will help you find them.
Yeah. Like,
that is my job, is help you find, you know, what you need. But I would do that anyway, because there are people who do love unconditionally, whether they know you or not, no matter the mistakes you make.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're not alone. It you don't have to be.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and don't trust the people that make you feel like you have to be. They're
yeah.
wrong.
Yeah. Exactly.
They're wrong.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you
Allie, for being on here. Caitlin Wilkinson,
yeah.
everyone, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces, hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.